You are listening to Eon. AEON.net.au.
You are listening to the TER podcast, the Teachers Education Review.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Teachers Education Review, the Australian podcast for teachers that bridges the gap between research, policy and practice. This is episode number 217, released on Wednesday the 29th of March, 2023. I'm Cameron Malcher. In this episode, Stephen Kolber looks at teaching English language learners as a form of cultural exchange. Tom Marnie questions the ideological underpinnings of the science of learning. I look at the federal government's recent announcements for further consultation on education. And for our main feature, I speak with Samantha McMahon and Megan Stacey about their recent paper, Exploring Student Metaphors for Learning in Western Sydney Schools. This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and extend those respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people listening to this podcast. Welcome back to the final episode for Term 1 of 2023. The next episode, of course, will be going out in the middle of the Easter school break. And so, for most teachers around the country, we are heading into the final week or weeks of term before getting that Easter weekend and then whatever autumn break your school or system provides you. If you listened to the last episode, I gave a breakdown of the education platforms of the three major parties going into the New South Wales state election. And that election was conducted over the weekend. And after 12 years in government, the Liberal National Coalition was defeated with significant swings against them, as much as a 20% swing in some seats, though I believe the average swing was just under 10% on average across the board. Now, despite significant swings in favour of the Labor Party, it does not look at this point in time like the Labor Party will be forming a majority government in their own right. They may well be just one seat short, because while there was a swing against the former government, that swing in many cases went in favour of independent candidates and not the Labor Party. So it looks like we may be in for a term of a Labor minority government, requiring them to negotiate with at least one or two members of the crossbench. At present, there look like being three Greens members and as many as eight independent members making up the balance of power in the lower house. So that in itself will provide for some interesting time ahead. The eight independents have some significantly different policy positions on education. Many of them are aligned more with the conservative side of politics. In fact, a couple of them are former Liberal Party members themselves who had to leave the party for various reasons. And we'll just have to wait and see. Of course, the upper house, the Legislative Council, as it's called in New South Wales, has not yet been fully counted. The only thing that seems certain is that the former kingmaker of the Legislative Council, the person who held the balance of power, One Nation's Mark Latham, looks to have not only failed in his bid to increase One Nation's power in the Legislative Council, but will also himself no longer enjoy that position of holding the balance of power, meaning that his time as the chairperson of the New South Wales Education Committee is probably over, and he will no longer have the influence over education in New South Wales that he has had for the last few years. And if you're not aware of the politicking that One Nation has been playing in New South Wales education, just as at a federal level, Pauline Hanson was successful in leveraging her power to have the family court system in Australia dissolved, Mark Latham similarly leveraged One Nation's influence to have professional learning for teachers in this state pretty much turned on its head to a large degree. While NESA, the New South Wales Education Standards Authority, claimed that it was all part of an ongoing review process, Mark Latham was very quick on social media to claim credit for the changes that happened to professional learning in this state, because he claimed that there were far too many woke courses being delivered to teachers, making the same sort of accusations we see coming out of parts of US conservative politics, accusing teachers of delivering courses on transgender behaviours like breast binding and penis tucking and all the strange claims that he made over the last couple of years, largely on social media, but some even in Parliament under the guise of parliamentary privilege. Anyway, all that is to say, it looks like Mark Latham will no longer have that influence, and we now wait to see what the new Labour minority government, most likely, will actually start to take action on in education. The new incoming education minister is Prue Carr, and she has been a Labour spokesperson for education for quite a number of years. Even going back to my time as an officer of the New South Wales Teachers Federation, she was one of the politicians alongside Jihad Dib who was most frequently present at education-related events, with Prue Carr being particularly connected to the issue of TAFE in New South Wales. But she is now both the Deputy Premier and the Education Minister, and we will just wait to see what their first action items of business are once they conclude the counting and form the new government. That being said, when it comes to education in the news later on in this episode, we're going to look at what federal Labor are doing with consultation on education and some of their plans for initial teacher education. But until then, it's time to get on with our first regular segment. And Stephen Kolber is back to discuss the teaching of English as an additional language in schools and treating it as a process of cultural exchange. So here now is Stephen Kolber with Kolber's Corner.
Hello, lovely people. Today we're going to be talking about what I feel is the best way to work with students with an additional language, whether we call that EAL or EALD. I'll call it EAL just for brevity's sake. But to me, the best way to approach working with an EAL student is to think of it as a process of cultural exchange. So in this sense, you are the holder of the dominant culture, the dominant knowledge. So, you know, in this example, we are the native English speakers. Your EAL students are coming to English as either, you know, we used to say a second language, but of course that holds connotations of ranking. So we merely say an additional language, but they are coming to English as an additional language. So they're learning it. They are learning it rather than acquiring it, if that difference is clear to anyone. So basically, no one had to teach you how to speak English when you were a little wee bebe because you acquired it. So that's basically what your brain is wired to do at that time. An EAL learner is learning it in the same way an adult might try and learn French on Duolingo or Japanese because they're a Sinophile or something similar. They're learning it in a logical, ordered and grown-up adult way rather than a young person who is acquiring it without much pain or that much effort. So the way we approach EAL for that reason is as a cultural exchange because they are learning about the structures and the rules and in many respects the cultural elements of English, and the easiest way to facilitate that is to make that same cultural step towards their language. So for me, there's a book that I value highly entitled Learner English, A Teacher Guide to Interference and Other Problems by Michael Swan. And that is, there is a version online that doesn't require money, but it basically, what it does is it takes interference, for context, is when your first language does a certain thing, approaches the language communication in a certain way, And English, in this case the target language, does that differently. So as a simple example, if you have Chinese EAL students, the Chinese approach to essay writing is more meandering, more circular, and it typically involves sort of quotes by important people. So if you think, you know, you might start with, you know, Confucius said, to use a very obvious and lazy Chinese example. In much the same way, an essay from the US might start with a definition from a dictionary, according to the Merriam-Webster dictionary. So culturally, these are things that are embedded in essay writing across those two cultures. In this, you know, Australian mainstream English approach, we approach an essay as much more of an argument. So we're saying, here's what I'm about to tell you, here are my three main points. So straight away you think three, you think, well, that's from, you know, the rule of threes, the Father, the Spirit, the Holy Ghost, you know, everything is a trinity, it's three part, that's a deeply cultural thing. Just think of the amount of times that you end a sentence with a list of three elements. That is a culturally embedded practice that comes to us from our language. So rather than try and explain to students in English, we love groups of three, and our essays are always in five chunks, and there are three main ideas. Rather than merely trying to communicate that, it's more interesting as a teacher, as a learner, as someone interested in the world, to approach it through, there's something we call paralinguistics, which is kind of the idea that you're meeting them halfway. You're sort of, you're taking parts of their language, trying to learn about them, and they're trying to take parts of your language. And so you're making a space where the two languages are able to meet and to mingle. So it's more interesting to say, for example, well, for the English language, the essay came to us from the Enlightenment period, where the focus was XYZ, and the first essay was written by this person, because it is a deeply cultural practice. And then you might say to your EAL student, how are essays approached in your culture, in your language? And they might be able to elucidate what that is or how those things differ. But by asking that question and trying to bridge that gap between the cultural differences, rather than simply saying, here's how we do it and this is the correct way, you can really reach some very interesting perspectives and interesting things. So, and the shortcut to that is this book, Learner English, A Teacher's Guide to Interference and Other Problems. So you can, for example, say, okay, I have a student, they're from an Arabic language background. You can go to the chapter about Arabic, and it will tell you things like, there are, for example, no articles in Arabic. So straight away, that's giving you a key to why their writing or their expression might be different. I have a student who speaks Hindi as their first language. Okay, so straight away we know English is a subject, verb, object. You say, the boy kicked the ball. Hindi is an SOV. So you say, boy, ball, kicked. The placement of those words is important, and that's one of the ways that things are communicated. The placement of those words within the sentence. And so that, again, if you understand that about your student, then you have something quite interesting that you can explore and something interesting that you can learn. If you simply approach it from, this is the way we do it here, it's SVO, and that's the rule, you're doing it wrong, then of course that's sort of not a learning opportunity as much as a dead end where the student is fixed or mended, or their approach to language is corrected. And of course, there is no correct approach to language. And as such, it's best to approach the differences, especially your EAL students, as people who have knowledge and understandings and culturally embedded practices that are interesting and fascinating to look at in comparison and individually, independent of comparison to English, and approach it as a cultural exchange first, rather than simply something that you're saying, here's the rule that we follow. At least to me, that's what makes sense, and that's what makes it most interesting. Until next time, keep reading, keep writing, keep learning.
And that was Stephen Kolber with Kolber's Corner. You can find him on Twitter at Stephen_Kolber, or look for the link to his profile in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. I'd also just like to take this moment to offer a special congratulations to Stephen and his wife Jemima, who in the last couple of weeks have welcomed a new addition to their family. So congratulations to both of you, and an extra special thank you to Stephen, who, despite having a new baby and all of the fun that goes along with that, still finds the time to record Kolber's Corner. So again, congratulations. Hope you're getting some sleep along the way. It's time now to move on to our second regular segment, and Tom Marney is back to look at the ideological underpinnings of the science of learning and how it positions the teaching profession. So here now is Tom Marney with Ideology in Education.
Welcome to Ideology in Education. If I was to ask you a question, such as, what does it mean to teach? Or, what is your role as a teacher? How would you respond to this question? These are the main sort of questions I like to look at when it comes to ideology in education. Because it's our understanding of what it means to be a teacher and what we do as teachers that is ultimately founded in ideological perspectives of what education ought to look like and what teachers ought to look like and what they ought to do. In this episode, I want to talk about the science of learning, a relatively hot-button topic at the moment that has a lot of people talking. And this movement actually has a lot to say about what it means to teach and what it means to be a teacher, sometimes in quite forceful ways, I must admit. But in this episode, I want to spend a bit of time looking at that movement, exploring some of its possible ideological roots, looking at the way that it defines the teacher and the role of the teacher in teaching students, and also providing a bit of a critique to that perspective. So here goes. So let's start by talking about the science of learning. Essentially, the science of learning is all about teachers using strategies that have been taken from neuroscientific research to allow our students to retain information and skills in the most effective and efficient way possible. And so this movement is grounded in the research of neuroscientists, all in relation to how the brain retains information and how information is stored in short-term memory and then in long-term memory, and how we can retrieve that and strengthen the connections, the neural connections in our brain. Now, although that was a fairly brief description of the science of learning, it does give some general indication of what the whole movement's about. It's about helping our students to more effectively and efficiently retain information in long-term memory. Now, that sentence in itself does give us some indication of what kind of ideologies might be influencing this movement. I would argue that the science of learning movement is founded within efficiency ideologies that see the role of education as a means of essentially shaping an individual for society in the most effective and efficient way possible. And I've previously talked about social efficiency ideology before in previous episodes of Ideology in Education. But essentially, this perspective sees the teacher as enacting the curriculum in a way that uses scientific techniques to just help students to retain that information. Often what I see when I look at the discourse surrounding the science of learning is that teachers are framed as technicians of learning. Their job is to ensure that the learning outcomes as prescribed in the curriculum are achieved by their students in the most effective and efficient way possible. And if they've done that, then they've done a good job. And so I think there is an assumption worth mentioning here in the way that the teacher is framed, is that if the teacher goes about imparting this knowledge and these skills in the most effective and efficient way possible, it will ensure that we have a better society. Now, from my perspective, that seems to be the general discourse surrounding the science of learning, is that if only our teachers were able to enact more efficient and effective techniques at helping our students retain knowledge, then the world would be a better place. Now, my question to you is, how do we know that? What I see when I look at the science of learning movement and the way that it frames the teacher as this technician of effective and efficient learning is that it actually bypasses some really important educational questions. So we can look at learning questions as being the content and how to retain it in our long-term memory, but we can think about educational questions as more of a holistic concept. We can think about education as being not just the content, but the whole person, how they're being socialized, and who they are as people entering this world. And if we're going to view education from a more holistic perspective, if we want to see the world become a better place, I don't necessarily think it's going to happen by applying effective and efficient techniques in teaching. Now, that might help, but I don't think it's the whole thing. I don't think it's the be-all and end-all. For example, if we just focus on the learning outcomes and try and achieve these as effectively and efficiently as possible, there is a chance that we might sideline some really important educational questions that should be guiding our practice, such as, what are some of the ethical ways that our students should be using this knowledge or could use this knowledge? And I find as a mathematics and psychology teacher, I'm often trying to think, how can I then bring this content, this stuff that needs to go into their heads, how can I use that knowledge to then help students think more deeply about their world, maybe about how they can use this mathematical knowledge in an ethical way? How can they ensure that data is used ethically? And how can they ensure that when we're looking at psychological characteristics, we're looking at people, we understand that we're not just looking at an object, we're looking at a person, a subject. These are just a couple of examples of some of the things I try to wrestle with that I believe are really important and go beyond just thinking about learning outcomes. And I think it's those broader perspectives that actually have a real chance at making a real difference. I think learning outcomes and learning content efficiently and effectively is helpful and important. But if that's the whole thing, we might be missing something. What do you think? Feel free to send me a message on Twitter or send me an email if you'd like to chat further. Otherwise, until next time, take care.
And that was Tom Marnie with Ideology in Education. You can find him on Twitter at TomMarnieEDU or look for the link to his profile in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. It's time now to take a look at education in the news. And over the past year, Federal Education Minister Jason Clare has announced a number of reviews and expert panels to provide input into a range of different issues in education. In the second half of 2022, an expert panel was formed to look at the issue of teacher education. It was chaired by the University of Sydney's Mark Scott, who is the former New South Wales Secretary of Education. And on the 23rd of March this year, that panel released its discussion paper on how teaching is taught at universities. Now, this discussion paper is open for consultation until the end of April or till late in April. And it focuses on several areas for reform, primarily including strengthening initial teacher education programs, drawing a stronger link between performance and funding of initial teacher education, so suggesting that possibly university funding will be linked to some measure of performance of teachers graduating from their courses. Improving practical teaching experience, so more hands-on, whether it's going back to the apprenticeship model of days gone by will, of course, wait to be seen. And enhancing postgraduate teacher education for mid-career entrants. And this has been an ongoing topic of discussion about whether people transitioning careers should be required to do a 2 years master's course in education or go back to the days of doing like a single year qualification. Now, to go into just a little bit more detail from the executive summary of the report, when they talk about strengthening initial teacher education programs, they have a few key points, one being focus on the brain and learning. So including effectively greater focus on educational psychology and understanding how people learn and why certain practices work the way they do. Connected to that is the idea of effective practices. They talk about knowing the classroom practices that have the highest impact on improving student learning, including breaking down and modelling work, effective feedback, literacy and numeracy teaching strategies. They also want to, under this point, have a focus on classroom management, setting up classroom environments so students can spend the most amount of time learning, and other enabling factors, such as having a foundational understanding of First Nations peoples, their cultures and perspectives, cultural responsiveness, and so on. The second point, strengthening the link between performance and funding of ITE. So they want to have a publicly available quality measure for initial teacher education programs that would drive the performance of higher education providers and help students make informed choices. So they are still looking for advice on how to assess the quality of ITE programs and how it should be linked to funding. I'm not going to hide the fact that I am generally opposed to any notion of performance pay or performance-based funding, because such measures are often counterproductive to the actual educational goals. Just as performance pay for teachers has always proven to be a disastrous strategy, and funding variations for schools and universities based solely on learning outcomes has not really been an effective strategy. And when people say, how do you know it's not been an effective strategy? Because it has been tried around the world in many different countries, in many different formats, and it's never become the standard way to do things, because it is a counterproductive strategy. It invites competition. It creates a motivation for cheating and for underhanded behaviors and strategies. And, you know, when you look to the US, a country that has taken that neoliberal idea of performance-based funding to quite absurd levels at times, the majority of states and school systems in the US that have tried performance-based pay or funding have ultimately scrapped it because it had detrimental effects on schools and education systems. So the fact that the panel are still looking for ways to connect, you know, they've got this idea, but they don't have a clear model for how to do it, and they're looking for advice on how to do it. We shall have to wait and see exactly how this plays out. But I've got to say, it's not something that I'm terribly enthusiastic or keen to see them pursue much further. There are tied up in this proposal notions of public transparency and accountability. Those things aren't necessarily a bad thing. You know, transparency is generally a positive thing, especially for public institutions. But when it starts to get connected to funding or to student performance in ways that may be beyond the institution's control, again, as I said before, it sort of creates a motivation and an environment where things might not go as intended, and the law of unintended consequences can kick in a big way. The third point about improving the quality of practical experience in teaching, they talk about basically wanting to improve the quality of practical experience with regards to best practice models used in education and other disciplines. They acknowledge that there is a limited evidence on the best models for practical experience, and that no single view, there is no single view on how to best approach delivery. Though one thing that does catch my attention in the discussion section of this box is that they're looking at opportunities to develop more comprehensive system-level agreements between school systems and higher education providers to improve the coordination and quality of placements. And reading between the lines, that sounds to me like they want to go back to the days of practical placements being part of teachers' awards and also being something that is funded and supported within the university. For those who have been around a bit longer, and I think back to my own practical experience, when I did my teacher training and did my practical placements, it was part of the New South Wales Public Sector Teachers Award that if you took on a prac student, you got a certain degree of either release time or additional funding, and it was paid and processed automatically as part of your salary. Under the Howard government, that was largely scrapped, and universities no longer got automatic funding and support for teacher placements. And more importantly, school systems no longer automatically paid teachers to do it. What that had the effect of doing was shifting funding for prac placements out of the school system and into the universities. So suddenly universities had to pick up more of the cost and more of the organization. And teachers who've been around a bit longer will tell you that once upon a time, prac teachers just used to turn up and do their prac. Now, if a prac teacher approaches you for a placement, you have to sign contracts with the university. It's a form of secondary employment. And there's a whole other degree of bureaucracy that the process is now wrapped up in. And, you know, I myself am currently doing a postgraduate qualification that requires me to do a different type of prac placement. And I have just literally had to sort the entire thing out myself. There's been no support beyond having a Moodle page to go to for information and a hotline to call in case of an emergency. But it's been entirely up to me to find and approach a school, coordinate the times, and do the prac placement. So as I said, reading between the lines of some of these discussion points, it sounds like the panel and the government are looking to get back to that systemic level agreement and hopefully some sort of systemic approach to funding, which may actually be a positive step forward by going back towards what we used to have. Point number four, improving postgraduate ITE for mid-career entrants. And in this one, again, they're talking about mid-career, people making a mid-career transition to teaching. Something that seems to get a lot of attention in the media and a lot of attention in policy discussion for something that has a relatively small number of people joining the teaching profession. There seems to be a real, I don't understand, I'm sure there are some numbers and statistics and data that I don't have access to that might make it look a bit more of a valuable part of the teaching profession. But from my understanding, the number of teachers who do make a mid-career change is disproportionately small compared to the amount of media time it takes up in the government's policy discussion. Anyhow, I'm sure, as I said, there's probably some data that I haven't seen or some information I'm not aware of that might suggest there is a bigger part of the teaching profession compared to those who either come out of high school or make their first degree some sort of education-related field. But I've just never understood the focus on mid-career teaching transitions. So they're talking about in this one, as I mentioned earlier, condensing the program to reduce time out of the workforce and loss of income, offering paid employment as an educational professional during the program, so trying to offset the loss of income. I mean, that is, for a person who's already in an established career who's interested in making a change to teaching, the salary cut in most cases to go to teaching itself is a disincentive and a barrier, but then to have to take a year off without pay to study full time is a big barrier, as is having to go back potentially to a beginning teacher's salary. So they're looking to address some of those issues. I will be very curious to see if anything they do in this field actually results in a significant increase in the number of people making that mid-career switch. It just doesn't seem to be a very popular or sought-after career change. So that's some of the key points from the executive summary. As I said, I will put a link to the discussion paper in the show notes for this episode, and consultation is open until the 21st of April. So that's one of the consultation expert panels that has reached another stage of public consultation. But just the day this podcast is released, just on the 29th of March, the minister also announced the formation of a new expert panel, which is to inform, it's called the Expert Panel to Inform a Better and Fairer Education System. Now, this panel is going to be chaired by Dr. Lisa O'Brien, who is the chairman and non-executive director of the Australian Education Research Organisation, or AERO, and is also associated with the University of Sydney. And this panel will be looking at specific reforms that should be tied to funding in the next National School Reform Agreement. So this panel is, once again, you know, if you're a regular listener, you'll have heard me talk about the Productivity Commission and the fact that our government discourse on educational funding seems to be caught up in this very conservative, neoliberal notion of productivity per dollar being the primary driving force of public spending as opposed to outcomes for the public. And the opening of this announcement does talk a little bit in those sort of terms. It says that the expert panel will zero in on how we can drive real and measurable improvements for students most at risk of falling behind and who need additional support. It says that we will also look particularly at students from low socioeconomic backgrounds and look at how we ensure public funding is delivering on national agreements and that all school authorities are transparent and accountable to the community for how funding is invested and measured. So it's, once again, it's good to hear a government talking about addressing socioeconomic inequality and inequity. There are undertones of efficiency and accountability that are not inherently bad, but could, you know, it's like the phrase productivity savings connected to any kind of funding increase. One of the big crises facing teaching at the moment is being overworked and not having enough either relief time or compensation for the work. And that's generally recognized as the factors driving our teacher workforce crisis in this country. So whenever discussion about funding is talked about in terms of productivity or accountability, the question always remains, well, what more can teachers be asked to do? What more can teachers possibly be asked to do to justify funding increases? And so obviously those sort of things will be what the panel will be looking at. But this is just an announcement of the creation of the panel. The one thing that does provide a bit of hope, and it goes back to the days of the Gonski campaign, what became the Fair Funding Now campaign, there is a statement towards the bottom of the media release saying that the Albanese government is committed to working with state and territory governments to get every school to 100% of its fair funding level. And it's good to see them using that language of the fair funding level, which was the title of the campaign that replaced the Gonski campaign. But it is a commitment to see the schooling resource standard implemented. And this panel will therefore be going into their consultation and their deliberations, looking at how to achieve that 100% funding. So it's another announcement. Now, as with the previous panels, there are a number of people attached to this panel to begin with, and more people are to be announced. Once again, there's a slight concern around the fact that the government is doing a sort of cherry-picked approach to consultation. They are picking the people they want to hear from, presumably those who will talk about the things they want them to talk about. And, you know, it's easy to be cynical. It's easy to say, look, they're picking people who will give them the answers they want to hear. But it's just generally, I suppose the thing about it that concerns me personally is that it's just a little bit anti-democratic. There's not representation on the panel from bodies that actually represent the teaching profession, whether that is professional associations, whether that is unions. And so the voices being selected are quite singular and will bring often, you know, sometimes very experienced perspectives, but still singular perspectives to what is a widespread social institution. Anyhow, that is the latest announcement. Looking to build a better and fairer education system, the primary goal being to get all schools to 100% of their schooling resource standard or their fair funding level, but a bit of uncertainty around how that will be achieved and what kind of expectations will be placed on schools, teachers, and systems to either offset or justify that funding. And I suppose those things will wait to be seen. You know, watch this space for future announcements. Just like the panel formed last August has only just in March this year released their discussion paper, this panel is expected to report back to government, I believe, late October. So we should be looking for a discussion paper in 6 to 7 months' time. Well, that's all for Education in the News. You can find links to those discussion papers and announcements in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. I'm going to take a short break now, and when I return, it will be with this episode's main feature, an interview with Samantha McMahon and Megan Stacey about their recent publication, Exploring Student Metaphors for Learning in Western Sydney Schools.
The Teachers Education Review is produced by teachers for teachers, exploring ideas to help improve teaching practices around Australia and around the world. If you like the TER podcast, you can help us to promote and improve the show. If you have an idea for a feature segment, a strategy you'd like to share as part of the Teachers Brains Trust, or if you would like to leave comments or feedback on one of our episodes, then please visit our website at terpodcast.com. where you will find information on ways to contribute to the show. To help promote the show, leave us a rating and a review through iTunes, Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, or whichever portal you use to subscribe to the show. Share your favourite episodes with colleagues, other educators that you know, or with anyone who has an interest in learning more about education. Finally, if you are organising an educational event and would like it to be considered for a feature on the Teachers Education Review, then contact us via email at info@terpodcast.com. Thank you for supporting the Teachers Education Review. Now please enjoy this episode's main feature.
This episode's main feature looks at a research paper that was first published in June of 2021 and was then republished in the Critical Studies in Education journal in 2023. The title of the paper is Exploring Students' Metaphors for Learning in Western Sydney Schools, and it was published by the team of Samantha McMahon, Megan Stacey, Valerie Harwood, Nada Labib, Alexandra Wong, and Sheila Daniel Mays. Now, this paper caught my attention because it unpacks something that doesn't often get discussed in a lot of the policy talk about education, and that is students' perceptions of their own learning and how those student perceptions align with or contradict the broader systemic goals that teachers might be working towards. And so I took the opportunity to speak with two of the authors' papers, Samantha McMahon and Megan Stacey, about how this research was conducted and what it really means to use metaphors for learning as a vehicle to understand students' perceptions and experiences of their learning experiences at school. So here discussing student metaphors for learning are Samantha McMahon and Megan Stacey. So joining me now to discuss metaphors for learning among students of schools in Western Sydney are the two academics who are part of the team that wrote the paper. Could you please introduce yourselves?
Hi. My name is Dr. Megan Stacey. I'm a senior lecturer at the University of New South Wales, and I'm the second author on this paper. So I'll throw now to the first author.
I'm Dr. Sam McMahon. I have an honorary position at the University of Sydney and was working at the University of Sydney when we did this research. I'm currently working as the learning manager at Bundanon, the arts institution just outside of Nowra.
Well, Megan, Sam, thank you very much for your time. We're here to discuss this paper, as we said, about student metaphors for learning and look at some of the implications from your findings over a two-year study. But just to start off, could you explain what you mean by metaphors for learning and why they matter in understanding education?
We were interested in hearing from young people about how they understand this idea of learning and themselves as learners, which is something that I guess we felt was not often asked of young people to articulate themselves in relation to these ideas. There's a lot of ideas about learning that are sort of put on students in different ways. So that was something we were interested in this project. But the metaphor aspect came from a set of metaphor cards that I think actually Sam had used in her teaching at the University of Sydney, but is also established in research as a way to kind of sort of an elicitation method is the term that's sometimes used in the research, methodological research literature, a way of sort of opening up conversations that can be particularly helpful when you are maybe working with young people and interviews can be a little bit intimidating maybe. So that was, I guess, some of the reasoning behind that. Sam, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I guess I can speak a little bit to how powerful I found metaphors as an educator. So we used these metaphor cards to help people explain to each other really abstract concepts. So it might be, learning is like a, or it could be a theoretical concept such as behaviorism is like a, and, you know, it, when you have to liken it to a rainbow or a sticky tape or whatever, you need to be able to articulate its parts and how you understand those parts. So it's kind of a really nice kind of way of drawing out people's understandings of a particular knotty concept. And when I knew I'd be working with young people and I knew describe yourself as a learner was perhaps an inappropriate question, I thought this might be a really kind of playful but helpful way to unknot some of those knotty thoughts around complex topics.
I mean, when you talk about metaphor cards to elicit responses, you know, my mind goes to, you know, Rorschach tests and those kind of images. What do the cards actually look like? What's on them?
So the cards that we used were actually designed by the Nevada Writing Project. They were used for a different purpose originally. And there's like a number, I can't remember, there's like 20 pages of icons. Maybe there's 9 icons to a page.
So 64 photographs in total.
There we go, 64 photographs in total. And they are of random objects. So it might be a cassette tape, a rainbow, a teddy bear, a book, a plant, a quilt. And the idea being these are just things that mean nothing until someone finds meaning in them or can infer their own meaning onto them. So they're very innocuous, non-blot-like tests or non-blot-like experiences. There's nothing testing about it, really. Yeah.
And so when you are using these cards with students to elicit a response about their perception of themselves as a learner, what does that interview process look like? Like, how much of an in-depth conversation are you having with each of your research subjects?
That's a good question. So we spoke to 47 young people in Western Sydney, and for 22 of them we spoke to them 2 years in a row, a year apart, and in each time we had a chat we spoke for about an hour on a range of topics, and the metaphor question was like a part of that interview. And the prompt that we gave everyone was to say, when I'm learn, I'm like a blank, pick a picture, because it's all about the reason they give. So they, when I learn, I'm like a teddy bear because, or when I learn, I'm like a plant because, whatever photo they picked, they had to explain their choice. And it was a very kind of easy part of the interview. It was very enjoyable. People, interestingly, some people picked the same picture a whole year apart, or a related one. So they picked the same metaphor but with a different picture. So it showed, I think, promise and consistency as a research method.
And what you say you did this as part of a broader interview.
Mm-hmm.
What was it you were hoping to understand from the broader interview in general? Like, obviously, this is part of multiple research strands, but what were you hoping to elicit specifically from the metaphor question?
Yeah, well, the project overall was actually an evaluation of a particular widening participation program at a university. And this was, I suppose, one of the things we were interested within that evaluation was to kind of track students developing understanding of themselves as learners as they participated in this program and sort of looked towards the possibility of tertiary education in the future. So, yeah, it was kind of one kind of indicator, if you like, within that broader, much broader project.
Mm. And I suppose this notion of a metaphor of the learner, it in my mind, one of the reasons that this paper caught my attention and sparked my imagination a little bit was because there's not often policy or political or even personal agreement on what it means to be a learner in a school. That's one of the constant challenges, you know, is it lighting a fire? Is it filling a pail? Is it, you know, memorizing and remembering and whatever else? And so that's one of the things that really caught my attention for this. When you went in asking this question, were you expecting to see more change? Like, Sam, you expressed a bit of surprise that some people, or it came across a little bit like surprise that some people chose the same image year on year. What were you expecting going into this?
Okay, so learning takes time. The reason it made sense to think about ourselves as learners was these young people were engaged in a program over their high school time, and we spoke to them at an interval that's long enough to imagine that learning or a shift in thinking or has happened. So by looking at something happening over time, there is a possibility for consistency and no change. There's also a possibility for change. And because we were particularly evaluating the impacts of a program, we used indicators that the program designers were interested in. And one of the things that they thought they could achieve was that they would help young people understand themselves as learners in positive ways. And so it was up to us to say, well, how do they think of themselves as learners, and what does that look like over a time period? I think what's really interesting was, to us, it was like one question in an interview, and we were struck by the patterns in the data. We wouldn't have necessarily predicted that we could find such discernible consistencies. Like you, Cameron, we understand learning to be a highly contested and highly personalised experience, and looking for patterns in self-concept of learner, qualitatively is not a pursuit many people take. So we were just really struck by the fact that we had all this data that had really strong patterns in it, and that's what made it worthwhile publishing about. It was a pleasant surprise.
Well, the other part of the title of the paper, and, you know, you specifically focused on students in Western Sydney. I'm just curious, what was the reason for targeting that particular demographic?
I think this was a project that was looking at the experiences of young people, as you said, in Western Sydney, which is an area of diverse cultural and linguistic groups with pockets of significant socioeconomic disadvantage, although that's not the universal experience. And I suppose we were interested in targeting that demographic because often students who are experiencing disadvantage can be kind of seen as at some kind of deficit within education. And so I suppose for us it was important to actually hear from these young people themselves. And I think very much in the results that came out of the study, we did not see that kind of deficit positioning really at all. Instead, we saw some really strategic and quite clever ways in which these young people were navigating their educational institutions. So that was something that that we were pleased to see sort of come out of that research.
Well, let's get into the actual findings and the conversations then. Like, how did these young people see themselves? What metaphors did come out of your conversations?
So we are using a kind of thematic analysis process. We categorise students' responses to this question across three main domains or ways of, I suppose, thinking about learning. The first was kind of the process of learning. The second was the time that learning takes and what can happen over time with learning. And finally, affective metaphors that students use where they talked about sort of how learning felt. And it was interesting to us to see the way in which across each of these kinds of domains, there were quite clearly contrasting conceptualizations, which we also saw as kind of aligning with broadly construed sort of behaviorist versus kind of constructivist approaches to learning, which we also saw in the sort of policy background, which we can speak to perhaps a little bit later. But if you like, I can provide some of the actual metaphors that students used across these domains.
Please.
Yeah. So when they were talking about learning as the process, we saw on the one hand, some students talk about learning as this kind of lifelong, active, perhaps more constructivist kind of process. One metaphor a student used was a camera. They picked a picture of a camera and they said, "I feel like a camera. Anything that's important, well, I think is important, I take a photo of it," which is like absorbing into the mind. All the pictures then turn into a film. And if I think that knowledge is still important, I might get that film captured to print it into actual photos that will stay with me. So this very kind of agentic kind of understanding. Another example is a student chose a platter of fruit and said, I chose the platter with the different types of fruit, and that's because I feel like I like to learn in many different ways. I don't just use one method of learning. I like writing notes. I like repeating it to myself. I like using flashcards, all of these different kinds of strategies that they had. But then on the other hand, with processes of learning, we had more sort of perhaps behaviorist ways of understanding learning. One student chose a hot air balloon and said, you know, "I'm like a hot air balloon because when someone's speaking, like the teachers, it's like the hot air runs in to the hot air balloon. It's like my brain. It's like getting filled with hot ideas. And then when they're not there letting in the air in, I'm back on the ground." So it's a slightly more deflated, if you like, kind of image.
There was a trend. So in this first example that Megan's talked about in terms of processes of learning, sometimes but not often being talked about as really active with lots of verbs, "I do this, I process that, I take this picture, I print it out," lots of active words in these metaphors showing that learning is a thing that is done and something they're in control of, which is very in line with constructivist notions of learning, where the learner sort of seeks the learning, does the learning, reflects on the learning, and then does something important with the learning, like apply it or whatever. Whereas the processes of learning that look more at sort of operant conditioning, these inputs, is positive reinforcement. And then when the reinforcers go away, the behaviour stops. That's kind of like behaviourist extinction. You know, so this is sort of, we're not saying that the kids have read learning theory and they're giving us metaphors specifically from one theory of learning or another, but we are saying that these theories of learning coexist and circulate at the policy level, at the practice level, at the pedagogy level, and they would feel these and understand these as a student in very different ways. And what's interesting is that even though they haven't learnt the theory, they can articulate very specific and very identifiable kinds of learning processes against those big overarching ideas of behaviourism and constructivism.
Go ahead.
No, the other thing I was going to say is just like in these examples, when we started mapping these domains against the theories, the more positive and happy thoughts of learning and agentic lifelong learning kind of ideas, which we hope for our learners, tended to sit with people who used metaphors that reflected more constructivist ways of understanding what learning is. Whereas the people who used more behaviorist kind of metaphors, or metaphors that align quite closely with behaviorist theories of learning, they tended to be a little bit more negative and a little bit more sad and deflated about themselves as learners. So I'm sure Megan can give you other examples too. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the ones that actually was used by a couple of students was sticky tape. A couple of students chose rolls of sticky tape and said, you know, well, I like sticky tape because, yeah, things stick to me, but just after a while I lose my stickiness and I don't feel like I have that knowledge anymore. It just kind of disappears. We had other metaphors like sort of passing clouds. There was one which was a little bit violent, like a piggy bank was chosen. But then the way the student described it was like, well, you put the knowledge in and then when you need to get it out for an exam or something, you go smash it open and then it's just, you know, that's it.
And then it's gone.
And the piggy bank is destroyed.
That's right. So again, with the more with the metaphors we've analysed as belonging more to the behaviourist approach, nothing seems to last, whereas the constructivist metaphors or the metaphors that seem more aligned with constructivism talk more about growth and permanency. So the plant that grows up or the quilt that is built and stays there, you know, as opposed to the running out of battery, passing clouds, smashing piggy banks and then it's gone kind of metaphor, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and then I suppose, just to jump in one more time, that was kind of reinforced further as well by that sort of third overall theme that we had around the sort of affective metaphors where, for instance, I guess we're looking at the way in which learning and understanding oneself as a learner makes these young people feel. And in the metaphors that we analysed as being more aligned with a kind of constructivist, agentive kind of approach, this was more active, more in control. But then in other ones, it was more a sense of kind of getting pushed around or one which we, there was a soccer ball, for instance, but one other one that we included and quoted in the paper is sort of really evoking feelings of stress and pressure. They said they chose a smoke alarm because I'm stable, but then when I get stressed or pressured, I give up, I get overwhelmed. So like with a smoke alarm, when there's too much heat or smoke or gas and then ding, 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 it blows up. So this kind of sense of building pressure, but not being in control of that and then kind of, yeah, explosion. Mm. So.
Wow. Now, yeah. You mentioned earlier that you categorized the responses into broadly behaviorist or constructivist approaches to education. And I think we see those terms, particularly constructivism, get used in a dozen different ways, particularly on social media. Can we just let people know quickly, what were your sort of working definitions of behaviorist and constructivist approaches to learning in this paper?
Okay, so these are very complex fields of study, but I will make a simple comment on each to give a sense of where we're coming from. So behaviorism will understand learning as a change in long-term memory, and it's something that happens through conditioning, through upper conditioning, through stimuli. It's a stimulus response psychology model. So you get given something and you're told it's correct or incorrect, or you get rewarded or punished or whatever. And so from this bunch of external stimuli and through practice, you learn the correct way of doing something or the correct answer to it or the correct process, and it becomes internalized and you are then able to use that correctly. So it works on the idea of knowledge as discrete, true things that can be learned through yes and no reinforcers, positive and negative reinforcers. Okay, so if we think of these true statements that are yes, no, learn, correct, no, correct, these kinds of ways of understanding learning are really useful when we want to measure it, when we want to find out who knows what and put it in a knowledge economy. So things like public exams and that kind of assessment is very suited to understanding learning as happening in this way. Constructivism, on the other hand, broadly defines learning as a shift in thinking, and they position the learner as agentic in the learning process. So whilst the learning environment and stimuli and the construction of learning experiences are very important, it's the learner's engagement with that environment, their choice of how to navigate it, their reflection upon it, their discussions with other people that help construct meaning-making and shared meaning-making. It's often construed as a social act, learning, as opposed to an internal one. So constructivism works on the tenet that you have to build knowledge, that you take pieces yourself from here and here, you put them together, you help them, you make meaning from it, you make sense, and you use that and in sort of dynamic and ongoing and reflective ways. You're permanently building up. And in that sense, there's not necessarily a point in drawing a line across it and saying, do you know it now? Let me test you. So it's less amenable to the examination assessment. It's more amenable to something like designing a product or writing an essay or having a debate on television and recording it and analysing it. It's much more, it might be about designing a really good question as opposed to coming up with a really good answer. So it's a different kind of assessment and a different kind of look and feel to a learning experience than behaviourism. The kids who were trying to revise, they're being really strategic. Like, it's not a bad thing. Behaviourism isn't a bad, constructivism isn't good. It's just that in their metaphors of how they felt themselves as learners, it had this really strong, divisive, affective kind of impact. And that's what's interesting.
You mentioned that the students who had more agentic metaphors tended to be a bit more enthusiastic about their learning, and the ones who had the behaviourist metaphors tend to be a bit more deflated, I think was the term you used. Out of the 47 students you spoke to, what was the sort of balance leaning in those two directions? Was it sort of a 50-50 split? Did you find more of them feeling in control or more of them feeling deflated?
It was probably more towards the deflated end, unfortunately. I wouldn't say it was, 10-90. Certainly there were lots of positive comments about learning and about enjoying learning and enjoying feeling in control of one's learning. But certainly those themes of kind of stress and pressure and needing the input to generate the output and being worried that learning won't stay and that will fade over time, that was something that was quite dominant in the data set, I would say. Sam, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, so I think the usefulness of this data, I agree with Megan's assessment that there was more of the behaviourist metaphors than not, and it wasn't by a massive margin. I don't want to essentialise a population saying that these guys are particularly stressed or deflated, but I feel like what this data shows, rather than patterns in a population, because it's really not a very big study, it shows that how you understand learning can really impact, or how you understand what learning is, can really impact how you feel as a learner. And I think what that matters about, like why that's important, is as teachers, as teacher educators, if we can develop a meta language about learning that clearly says what we think learning is and how we hope learning feels and what the processes for that would look like are, rather than just going through and doing of the learning in particular ways, that could be really fruitful for young people who are feeling really crap about it. And that's not to say that you have to abandon giving tests. Like, that's not a pragmatic or practical thing to say. but maybe you can contextualize, okay, yes, this is an examination. We have to jump through this. We do need to just get some answers out, show how much we know to be correct, blah, 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 blah. But it's just a test. What we care about is, do you know what I mean? Like, we can have sort of conversations about what's important in learning. And if we really want people, as the policy landscape hopes for, to be agentic lifelong learners, we want them to feel good about it, because otherwise they're not going to do it as soon as they don't have to. So, do you know, like, so yeah. I think that's the issue that we've uncovered, is not so much that the metaphors are different even, or but the fact that particular kinds of understandings of learning can lead to negative feelings. That's an important thing for educators to ponder and take forward in their pedagogy.
I mean, it sounds like a very effective way to unpack a student's, you know, that link between self-perception and motivation. It sounds like you've sort of found a very effective bridge to get them to elicit their sense of self as it relates to that motivation and engagement for learning. I suppose the question then is, in the context of your broader study, did those trending groups in the metaphors correlate with any other aspect of the data you were gathering about these students?
Yes. So it correlated strongly with the kinds of activities and the kinds of outreach that they valued compared to the things that they did not value. So if we think about the positive metaphors around constructing learning and being active in the learning process, when we were talking with them about the outreach they'd been engaged in, the things they loved were the bits that were constructive. So the conversations with university students who were there, the physically finding things on campus, going and doing things on, you know, creating things with people. Things they did not like were practice tests for NAPLAN, things they found added to their repertoire but not expanded their knowledge was things like practicing exam technique and study techniques and things. So so it did map across some of their descriptions of the things that they experienced in the outreach that went well for them and that didn't.
Mm. And just to pick up there just quickly on a point related to, you know, Sam mentioned NAPLAN and not enjoying doing practice NAPLAN tests and things like that or whatever it might be. And Sam also mentioned, you know, it's not practical to tell schools and teachers to, well, don't do tests, don't do exams. One thing that I want to pick up on is that these ideas about learning and what it is to be a learner are coming from somewhere, and it's not, we don't think it's really just schools and teachers. We think it's probably a bigger systemic question that's behind that as well. And when we see these kind of conflicting, not necessarily mutually exclusive, but kind of distinct ways of understanding oneself, we also see that in the kind of overarching policy scape that's sitting behind and underneath schools and students and teachers. You know, so while on the one hand we have these really aspirational policy documents like the Mbundwa Declaration, or perhaps we can look to other examples like the emphasis on 21st century learning that comes through from the OECD, for instance, this is much more that kind of a constructivist, agentic, lifelong conceptualization of learning. But then when we see the way in which students are actually having to sort of perform day to day with things like NAPLAN, the HSC, that is really more tailored towards an input-output kind of structure of learning. So I think that there are things we could think about at a bigger, broader level when we're trying to talk about ways in which to support students to understand themselves as learners in really positive and helpful ways.
Though, that notion that one of the things that a lot of students reported on negatively or having negative attitudes towards were things like practice NAPLAN tests. Now, obviously, students are going to be encountering that kind of content in various educational contexts. Were you able to identify or get any understanding of why some students might have had that experience and come away from it negatively, and other students might have taken that on board and just gone, yes, but I'm still a lifelong active learner? Is there, was there something about their particular school experiences, or was it just a quirk of their response, I guess?
So I feel like, and this is, I have to say, we finished this study a while ago, but my memory of this is that we didn't went on the activities that we observed and the interviews about said activities in situ that we did. So it was a mixed design. So we physically went and observed things happening and talked to people in situ as with four schools, and those four schools weren't the people that we asked the longitudinal questions of. They had experienced the same program, but it was, we felt it was ethically too much for any one school or bunch of kids to have us follow them for 2 years and do longitudinal studies with them. Mm. So we followed one set of four schools to observe what was happening and gather information and in-time data. And then we did the longitudinal aspect of the story with kids who'd done exactly the same activities in four comparable schools. And so in some ways it's a little bit of a false question because we can't really match the two data sets directly.
I don't think that we necessarily are trying to say in this paper that there are students that only understand themselves in this kind of yes. behaviorist way or only in this kind of constructivist way. I think probably most students are drawing on different kinds of understandings of themselves at different times in different situations. And I don't know that we're trying to put them necessarily into a box, even though they might have given us a metaphor that leans in one direction, you know, on one particular day when we're interviewing them.
That's beautifully said. I agree. Okay. And I think, thank you. I was trying to get there, but I couldn't quite get there. So I agree. And I feel like not only do people draw on different metaphors to explain different things, I think people are very pragmatic and, Megan said before, strategic about what works for them in particular situations. Of course, revising and learning discrete answers and aiming for correct and incorrect sort of differentiation in learning when you're learning to study for an exam is important. It's essential. We can't say that it's a bad thing. It's like it's just the way the structure is kind of guiding the learner to be in that moment. And that's not to say even that they have an experienced pedagogy from their teachers that is highly constructivist. Maybe they go to classes every day and are deeply engaged in the class itself, but then have to go through this process that they're less fond of, that it's more behaviorist just to do the hoop jumping of the examination. So we're not pretending that behaviorism and constructivism are mutually exclusive, that they don't coexist at the policy level, at the practice level, but there are structures of schooling and there are policy structures that privilege particular kind of understandings of what knowledge and learning are compared to others, and having that examination and that discrete knowledge that's positively reinforced privileged so frequently seems to be having an impact on what kids think learning is, full stop. That is becoming what they think learning is, not what they think learning can be for life or what they think learning could be in other ways, shapes and forms.
Though I suppose another element to the way that I was thinking when I asked that question was also, is there a difference in the way that the experiences are presented in the school? Is there potentially a contextual difference that leads to a different interpretation of common experiences?
Of course. I would say even within schools, between classrooms, they'll have very different experiences of what is expected, what learning is understood as, and how they're expected to show and engage in learning in that space. So I don't for a minute want to characterise a school as engaging in more or less of one type of pedagogy or other, but we do point to some literature in the beginning of the review, the literature review in the article, that shows that sometimes schools that are under-resourced and experience children with varied and high needs, such as schools situated in low socioeconomic areas, do sometimes revert to very simple, low-level behaviorist understandings of what's required, but that is in no way universal, and I don't want to come off as saying that so. So because we also point in the literature review to schools in those contexts who pivot and do very differently. And maybe, Megan, you could talk to some of those.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely all of the sort of productive pedagogies research, plenty of research on sort of turnaround schools and things like that. So while we do recognise that in the literature there is a body of work that looks at some of these I suppose, retreats to more comfortable practices sometimes when schools are working in contexts with students who are experiencing various forms of disadvantage. At the same time, that doesn't mean that that's what all schools are doing. And I suppose we're also wanting to recognise there that this work of teachers in schools like that, where there are students experiencing disadvantage, is often very challenging work. It's very highly engaged work. It's creatively and intellectually very high level labour that they're doing. So we certainly wouldn't characterise, based on the data that we gathered, any of these schools as particularly one way or the other. And that's the other comment that I was going to make in response to this, is that we didn't see any pattern across the schools that we included in this study looking to say that anyone was doing particularly different work to the others. So the kinds of patterns in metaphors that we observed were sort of similar across the different schools.
And so what do you see as the implications for these research findings for schools and education more broadly?
Well, I mean, I think that there are probably some questions to ponder arising out of this project, more so perhaps than answers. But I suppose when we're looking at the sort of policy level, we might query whether there might need to be a little bit more alignment in the kinds of learning that is valued and how it's valued, and particularly kind of the distinction between talking the talk and walking the walk, perhaps. You know, there are documents that say things and then there are practices which seem to say other things. So maybe there's something to reflect on there.
As the host, I can be a bit less diplomatic than you and say, you know, having a policy document that describes learning as a lifelong process, but the only thing we're going to measure you on is standardized tests that are given almost every year without any reprieve, leads to a bit of a conflict in what's said and what's done.
Perhaps, yeah.
I wouldn't mind. We actually put three questions forward at the end of our paper, and I think the best answer to your question is to pose more questions, and that's not because we're being glib. It's because this is really new work. No one has come up with the fact that young people feel differently about themselves depending on the kinds of metaphors of learning that map against different kind of explanations of learning. And so there is no answer yet. But what there is there's really clear directions for finding out more. And we invite all our colleagues and practitioners to join us in finding out. And here's the three questions. The first question is, if high school students don't see themselves as lifelong learners, if they feel themselves as deflated and stuck in this cycle of short-term impermanent learning, how can this impact or not decisions about tertiary studies? And what might this mean for university outreach programs? So, you know, if learning sucks and feels terrible, who's going to do it forever? You know, at a fundamental level. So how can we shift understanding and feelings of what learning is so that it is inspiring to keep doing it for the rest of your life? That's one thing to think about. Another thing to think about is, well, what does that mean for university outreach programs? So if university outreach programs are just assuming that kids who are experiencing complex lives or experiencing socioeconomic disadvantage need to be inspired to come, we need to be telling young people what learning is like at uni and how much of that temporary, short-term, in-out, let's just get through the exams there is, what disciplines are more geared that way than others. You know, like we need to be having really helpful conversations about is uni like school or is it different? In what ways, you know, and can you imagine yourself learning as a different learner in a different context, you know? And I don't know that that's a very popular route yet for outreach. It's all about university marketing, subject selection, applying for scholarships. Talking about what learning is like when you get there is not a large proportion of what happens in outreach programs. But it's something that the young people love, yeah.
I suppose we should take a moment to pause and reflect on the implication that learning is not at the heart of recruiting people to university.
Well, I mean, I think that's probably learning in the technical sense. Like, we don't talk about how we do it. We talk about that you do it and you get a qualification and you'll be able to do things you never could do before you came. Like, there's definitely that sense of learning, but not the how. And not how is it different.
Yeah, the process of it is kind of just assumed.
Yeah, and not how is it different to this thing you haven't enjoyed so far or that you don't think you like doing. So that's an interesting question. The next question is, if teachers at school are invested in developing lifelong learners, and I'm sure we all are, what pedagogic practices might need to alter in order to shift students to this view of what it is to learn and be a learner? So how do we go about our work in such a way that learning is felt in positive ways and that it's understood as multifaceted and, okay, partially this thing, but importantly this thing and so forth and so on? How do we create learning environments and learning experiences that say, hey, this is learning and this is the good stuff, this is the good feelings, we want to do more of this tomorrow and the next day and in 10 years' time? You know, how can we do that as educators? And I think we always strive for that, to be completely fair, but we must be missing the mark a little bit if kids are running around feeling, oh, you know. So there's that question. And then the last question is, if teachers need to do this work, how can teacher educators, that's people like me and Megan, prepare them to do it? How can we teach about teaching in such a way that this is part of the gig? This is part of how you prepare. This is part of how you deliver. These are kind of the fun meta languages we can put around learning to kind of create a learning environment that learners can engage with and have these kinds of experiences that might make them think about learning in more constructive and positive ways.
So for anybody who'd like to know more, obviously the link to the paper itself will be in the show notes for this episode. Is there anywhere else you'd recommend they go to read up on this topic?
There is, in terms of constructivism and behaviorism, there's a really beautiful book that has chapters written by people from constructivist discipline with questions from co-authors who've written in the behaviorist discipline and then answers. And so it's a really nice kind of exploration into the limits and complexities of considering the world in black and white from behaviorism and constructivism. I can't think of the name of the book right now, but I will send you the full reference and a link to our library. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I'll make sure that title is linked in the show notes as well. Well, Megan, Sam, thank you for your time. It's been a fascinating conversation and my mind is still whirling with the possibilities of finding this bridge between student self-perception and their motivation and enthusiasm for learning in school. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And that was Samantha McMahon and Megan Stacey discussing the paper Exploring Students' Metaphors for Learning in Western Sydney Schools. You can find a link to that paper and to the books and resources mentioned in the interview in the show notes for this episode at terpodcast.com. It is time now to thank our highly accomplished patrons. These are the members of the TER audience who have chosen to support us over on patreon.com/TER podcast at the highly accomplished patron level of $10 Australian per month. And special thanks go out to Lee and to Malcolm Young, our two longest standing highly accomplished patrons. Thank you for your ongoing support and for helping to keep things going here at the TER podcast. Listeners, if you would like to join their ranks, please make sure to go to patreon.com/TER podcast or look for the links in the show notes for this episode, where you can join for as little as $3 a month, which is about $1.50 an episode, less in the months when we put out three episodes. And your ongoing monthly contributions help meet the ongoing and increasing costs of hosting and online services to produce the TER podcast. Otherwise, that brings us to the end of this episode. Wherever you are, I do hope you have a good end to term one, that you are looking forward to some sort of break over the Easter long weekend and indeed the Easter holidays, whenever they may happen for you. I'll be back in a fortnight in the middle of what will be the Easter break here in New South Wales with the next regular episode. But that's all for now. And until next time, this has been the Teachers Education Review.
Thank you for listening to the Teachers Education Review. All opinions expressed in this episode are those of the individual speakers only and do not represent the views of their employers or any other affiliated organisations. For links, show notes, and information on how you can contribute to the Teachers Education Review, be sure to visit terpodcast.com.
This podcast is part of the Australian Educators Online Network. AEON.net.au